You are listening to a Science Actually production.
Welcome to TTI McScratchies, where it's constantly New Year's Eve. Here we go again. 3, 2, 1.
It must be wonderful to ring in the new year over and over and over.
Please kill me.
I mean, things are happening. Bless you. I feel like there are many things happening. We should do a whole episode to talk about all the things that are happening.
We're talking about things that happened.
Talking about things that happened, not things that are happening.
Happened.
God, what do you call that thing again? When a word loses all meaning when you say it too many times?
Satiation.
Somatic satiation?
Somatic satiation.
Happened.
Hey, everybody.
Hey,
welcome
Benjamin.
To another electrifying episode of The Nerd and the Scientist, starring your favorite astrophysicist, Kavi Rose, who's probably much warmer as his side of the planet is closer to the sun than I am, your friend Benjamin, who's in the northern hemisphere, tilted away. And like a typical Californian, it's 60 degrees and I'm shivering.
60 degrees.
It's a Fahrenheit joke, Javi. It's a Fahrenheit joke.
Fahrenheit. I don't know Fahrenheit. I work in degrees Kelvin. actually. How you doing, Benjamin?
I am doing good. Happy to see you. Happy to talk more about science things. It's a good way to spend the day.
It's great. And, you know, we teased this briefly in our last episode, which was kind of a crossover fun flashback episode with Space Case Sarah Treadwell, which was awesome. But we teased the fact that this season we are going to be having, this upcoming season, a lot of awesome guests. We have some good folks coming on, and we're just going to talk science. We're going to hear about them.
Let's talk science.
What they do, where they come from. We already have some incredible scientists and science communicators lined up for y'all, including we have some science comedians. We have folks who work at SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. There's a lot.
We're bringing it down to Earth. We got our first biologist coming on.
Yes.
That's going to be awesome. We have an author. Great. So buckle up, everybody.
Buckle up. We're going to be bringing the science to you live, or a slight delay. We may actually be bringing the science to you live at one point as well, but more.
Yes, we're working on a live episode. That's right.
Yeah.
It's going to be exciting. Live episode. But that's what's coming up this year.
That's what's coming up this year. But what about last year, Benjamin?
Last year, so much happened in the world of, in the space of space.
Space of space. Space.
Sure. In space, a lot of things have happened. 2024 was a banner year for space exploration.
Mm-hmm.
So much happened. We had the Polaris Dawn, which is the first private spacewalk in history.
Right.
Group of people simply rented a SpaceX capsule and paid SpaceX for the ride, and they opened the door and out they went, and ha-ha. Private spacewalk.
I'm just picturing Jared Isaacman like stepping out into the vacuum of space in his suit, and everyone at Mission Control is just like waiting and listening for what his first words are going to be. And it's like, crackle, crackle, ha ha. I don't know what his first words were, but that would have been spectacular.
It would be awesome if you got out there and said, Earth. Okay. Back inside he goes.
Smaller than I was expecting, but... No, that was phenomenal. I wonder, are they having another... Because that was their second mission, right?
Jared Isaacman has been to space, I think, a few times on SpaceX that he himself chartered and with the crew he brought. And this was the second or third time that he went.
This was the second crewed mission. I remember was the one that Cyan Proctor, our friend and science communicator, was on, which was amazing. And that they had like this wonderful glass dome atop the capsule. Mm-hmm. But this one they got to go outside.
Yes. I love that dome capsule on that thing, because what a lot of people don't know about the the Dragon capsule, they know where the windows are, they know where the seats are, they know where the storage is, but where's the restroom? The restroom is contained inside a panel in the ceiling, which is great. And then when they reconfigured this capsule that had that beautiful glass dome offering 360-degree panoramic views with no interference. There's no obstructions, no metal between like glass panes. It's one singular smooth glass dome. Right below that, there's the panel for the restroom. And just below that, there's just a curtain that you pull across. So when you have to go to the restroom while the canopy is opened and the cupola is exposed so you can see the Earth, while they're there, they had to go to the restroom. It was the most amazing time ever to go to the restroom, because it's just you and your most private moment and the view of a lifetime.
Yeah. Love it. Love that. Wow. Okay. So there is.
Anyway, that's the 2024.
But yeah, no, it was amazing to see the first private spacewalk that they did, Polaris Dawn mission. SpaceX, it was a big year for them, eh?
SpaceX was huge. First of all, they did 134 launches last year. And that's just of the Dragon capsule. There were 259 launches worldwide, and 134 of them, more than half, was SpaceX.
Whoa.
Their previous record was 98 launches in the year of 23, so they broke that record. And they want to do 144, 12 a month. Didn't make it, but still, you know, things happen.
It's more than I'm doing.
Hard, the other delays and things, so... Unbelievable. And they launched the new mighty Starship several times in 24. This big behemoth. Some of them exploded, some of them crashed, and then some of them, had a controlled crash. And then they finally caught them with the big giant chopsticks that they've built in Kennedy. They actually called them chopsticks.
The BGCs, the big giant chopsticks. Yeah, it's the work that they're doing there under the supervision of Gwen Shotwell is just, it's spectacular. It's really impressive. There are very few companies who are doing this reusable launch kind of exploration, and they're doing it really damn well, really damn well.
They are absolutely moving fast. It's fantastic. I remember Google had the mantra that they move fast and break things. And that was a big, big thing. And they still kind of do. Not as much. But it's nice to see, because it's compared to SpaceX, it's a much older and established company. SpaceX is still young in comparison. So they have the time, they have the money, apparently, to just, let's just try it. Let's build it and send it. Let's see what happens. Let's go. It's been incredible to watch, and I'm looking forward to Starship really. I bet you this year, 25, Starship's going to start maybe possibly launching a person and it's gonna make it to Mars. Not this year, but in time. That thing's clearly gonna work.
It's impressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, we also saw the launch of everybody's favorite Blue Origin ship.
Yes.
The long awaited New Glenn.
Blue Origin's New Glenn. That was, didn't it launch in January though?
Oh, you know what? You might be right. There were delays.
It was supposed to go up in November, then December, and then finally went up in this year. So we'll talk about it in next year's roundup.
Yeah, never mind. Ignore that. We'll talk about it next year.
Ignore. But it was awesome. Do check it out.
Yeah, we will check that out.
Mars. NASA has a helicopter on Mars called Ingenuity. And it had its first flight in 2021. It was only supposed to fly a few times for some short distances, just a proof of concept. But that thing flew 70 times over the years it was there. And its final flight was January of 24. Incredible. The distances it covered, the speed in which it covered those distances, just left all the rovers in the dust, quite literally, because it had to touch down and there's dust. But it's still too small to actually carry like experiments and all that other kind of stuff. So it's just camera and some recording devices, and it's so awesome.
It's so cool. I think we'll be seeing a lot more missions like that now that they know that we have the technology to do it.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Cray.
We also had, speaking of flying NASA missions, we had the Europa Clipper launch.
Yes.
That was this year, right?
Yes.
As in 2024.
Launched in October. Europa Clipper is scheduled to do a bunch of gravity assists as it pinballs around the inner solar system this year and also in 26. And should arrive in Jupiter in 2030.
Wow. Solar system's big.
I'm just taking a moment to appreciate the sound of that year. Sounds like the future. It is the future, but not like space cars and Jetsons future. Just
wow. I mean, we could have space cars by then.
Well, there is a car in space. Oh, did you see the news? Oh, it was great. Yeah. It was great. An asteroid's coming. Small little rinky dinky thing. And what is it? It's the Elon's car that he launched.
The Tesla Roadster.
Yeah. The Tesla Roadster is coming back. It's not going to hit us. Even if it did, it would burn up. It's nothing. But it's coming back.
I wonder if the way they figured it out was, you know that guy, Aaron Reich, who works for the Jerusalem Post, mm-hmm. and every time there's a near-Earth asteroid, he always says, it's an asteroid the size of 3 washing machines. And this time he saw the report, and he's like, oh, an asteroid the size of a Tesla Roadster. And then the folks at JPL were like, wait a second.
It is.
What color did you say?
First time he's like accurate. It's the first time he's 100% accurate.
Yeah, shout out to Aaron if he's listening. Great.
Oh, man. Does that make it? Well, we do have a problem with space junk in our orbiting our planet and everything.
It's a big problem.
Is it, does, since this is a car, does this make it space traffic?
Honestly, I mean, space traffic just by itself, with like actual actively managed spacecraft and satellites is pretty hectic. I mean, if you look at geostationary orbit, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are orbits that are really highly sought after because they're trying to manage the traffic of all of the satellites that are up there in those specific orbital paths. It's definitely space junk.
Huh.
Yeah. It's been a very... Yeah. What do you wonder about?
Well, say I have a satellite. I am some random country, and I have a satellite that I want to put in geostationary orbit, and I just go ahead and launch. Mm-hmm. Do I have to let, is there some law, some international law that says I have to let NASA and JAXA and the ESA and the ISRO and everybody else know? Or do I just send it up there and say, all right, everybody, now my thing's there. Now that's something you have to worry about.
That's a good question. I imagine that between all of the major spacefaring countries, there are agreements that manage that space, and each country's aviation authority, like the FAA, right, in the US, would monitor and manage the launches from within their own country. I don't know what would happen if one of the countries that wasn't part of that just suddenly, you know, launched something up. That's an interesting question. It probably would not be a good idea. Bad thing.
No, definitely not a good idea. Absolutely. I'm not saying this is a thing someone should do. I'm just wondering, how did people find out?
Now, we're pretty good at monitoring the stuff that's launched into space. Hopefully that is the sort of thing that could be recognized and any risk avoided. I think most people who have the, let's say, technical abilities to launch something like that would also be aware of the potential hazards of launching something in an uncontrolled manner into a highly trafficked part or highly trafficked orbital path, right? We've spoken, I think, in previous episodes about the idea of Kessler syndrome, where if you have one, you know, massive collision between spacecraft, all the little pieces will then knock on and potentially impact other spacecraft, and then you can basically just like flood the orbit with a bunch of debris, and then everything would be pretty unpleasant. It would basically, you know, destroy the internet and global telecommunications, and nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that. We need that internet.
We need that internet for my cat videos.
I don't like it, but I like it.
It's great. All right, Benjamin, do you have an ad for us?
I do.
All right, show me what you got. What's this week's ad brought to you by ChatGPT?
Kavi, are you tired of boring Earth-based coffee? Wish your morning brew had just a little more adventure?
Ooh.
Well, brace yourself for Space Brew, the only coffee made from NASA's state-of-the-art closed-loop water recycling system. That's right. Every sip of Space Brew has been through rigorous purification, ensuring that yesterday's coffee is tomorrow's coffee. Just like the astronauts on the ISS, you too can enjoy the bold, robust, recycled taste of that brew that's been poured into your cup again and again and again. Some companies have returns and exchanges policy, but not Space Brew, as every sip has already been returned and exchanged. Space Brew, because in space, every drop counts.
Oh, that's amazing.
I'm going to have surely a sip of my coffee now. That's gross.
Wow. I mean, I always wondered why we don't have the same amazingly efficient, water recycling facilities on Earth like they do on the International Space Station. And I guess my kind of visceral reaction to hearing that ad probably should tell me everything that I need to know. Oh, that's great.
The phrase, yesterday's coffee is tomorrow's coffee, is an actual quote by astronaut Don Pettit while he was aboard the International Space Station, when he was making a funny wisecrack about the water recycling system. Which, by the way, is insanely efficient up there. It purifies all moisture in the air and stuff you make pee pee. something like 90-something% of all the liquid is recycled purified and clean, and you don't taste anything. But the joke is,
Yep. No, that's fair. That's
these
fair
water molecules have visited you before.
Oh man. Speaking of spending a long time in space, going around and around, I think there was a record set this year by Russian cosmonaut Oleg Kononenko. I think he set the record for the longest or accumulated largest amount of time in space, which was 1,111 days in space over the course of five missions. that's wild.
That is crazy.
All that time drinking the same coffee every day.
Speaking of spending a long time in space, last year, the first crewed launch of Boeing Starliner sent astronauts Barry, Butch, Wilmore, and Suni Williams to the ISS. Mm-hmm. There were some problems with it. Thruster malfunctions, some weird sounds, etc., etc. So Butch and Sonny were asked to stay, and the Starliner returned via remote, perfectly safe and sound, but left Butch and Sonny on the space station for an incredibly long stay. They're supposed to come back, I believe, February next month. Mm-hmm. They have had a long stay, and in doing so, Sonny now has the record for longest time spent total collectively over her career, EVA.
Okay.
Nice. She has gone outside so many times, and congrats to her. She spent something like a total of, I didn't write it down, which would have been smart, I think several total days worth of time outside the space station, just doing whatever it is. The funny thing about it is, in the beginning, when they were, air quotes, stranded in the aboard the space station, everyone was worried, and it's, you know, bad news for Boeing and shame on Boeing, and you left these people there, blah 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 blah. Yes, that's unfortunate. Boeing couldn't bring them back, but if you actually speak to Butch and Sonny, they couldn't have been happier to get stuck on the space station, because that's every astronaut's thing. Yes, yeah. We're stranded here, but we're kind of stranded in space, which is awesome. That's what they train for. Every astronaut goes up there for a week hoping for an extra day or whatever. They got several months.
More than they bargained for. I think a lot of the headlines from media outlets were a little bit misleading. It's not like, you know, you're stuck on a desert island and you don't have food or water. You know, most resupply missions that are providing, you know, supplies tend to be supplying one or two resupplies in advance, meaning if a supply mission, let's say, you know, a non-crewed mission explodes on the launch pad or doesn't make it, it's not like, oh no, that was their only food. They have backups upon backups. This is how NASA and most space agencies operate. So it was fine. It's also a good thing that, you know, they had that ability to keep them somewhere safe while they brought the Starliner capsule back to Earth without humans aboard. I mean, this is something that folks talk about with respect to Challenger and, you know, the Columbia space shuttle disaster with the STS-107, right? This was, with Columbia, they had identified the problem on launch, but had basically said, no, it's fine. This one thermal tile that was damaged, like, won't be an issue on reentry. And it's good to see now that, you know, the space agencies have learned the lesson and are playing things much more conservatively, like with the resupplies. You know, they have a safe way to manage situations rather than taking risks with human life. So, yeah, overall, I see it as a win for space flight development, certainly a win for the astronauts, like you said, getting to spend a bit more time up there.
It's true. And also, we mentioned the water recycling up there. The air scrubbing up there is also incredibly efficient as well. The carbon filtering that they do. And there, in the resupply missions that you mentioned, they bring water and they bring fresh water and they bring fresh air, of course. But what they have up there is being reused so efficiently. It's a shame. It really is a shame that the ISS has to come down.
Yes,
it's working so nicely.
They announced this year actually that SpaceX was selected to be the launch vehicle that would help deorbit the ISS, I think, in 2030.
Yeah, something like that. It was going to be 25 or 26, but then they got an extension before they could bring it down. Basically, what they're going to do, a Dragon capsule is going to dock and then just fire the thrusters and push it into the Pacific. And
yeah.
Sad.
It's like a reverse tugboat.
Mm-hmm.
Basically. Yes. It was a big year for space exploration and space news in terms of rocketry. But on my side of space, on the astronomy and astrophysics side of space, it was also a pretty big year. There was some impressive news, some impressive headlines. There were some impressive sights that you could see. If you happened to be in a clear area, there were a ton of aurorae that were visible this year by everyone except me. We are approaching the solar maximum, the period of maximum activity from the sun during its 11-year cycle. The thing is, with the solar maxima, you don't really know when the maximum was until it's passed, once you start seeing the decrease. So it kind of started last year. It looked like it's going to continue into this year, into 2025. But the cool thing about more solar activity means more aurorae, more northern lights, more southern lights. So if you are in an area that is close to the north or south pole, and you hear about a solar flare, or a CME, or any sort of like heightened period of solar activity, go and see in the evening if you can check out some of the northern or southern lights. I still haven't seen them my whole life. Makes me very sad.
I haven't seen them. They were reaching all the way down towards the San Francisco Bay Area, where I live.
Oh my gosh.
And we did our best. We got in the car and we drove away from the city. Still, the city lights are even far away. They're bright enough to wash out the northern lights. So we drove even further and further away. And still too close to the city. So light pollution is a thing. You need to really, the further away you are from the poles or closer to the equator, the further you're going to have to go from a big city if you want to see them. I'm happy to know that they're still going to be going on for a bit, so I will try.
Yeah, you should still have a few more chances. I mean, they were technically visible as far north. The southern lights were visible as far north as Sydney, but unfortunately it was naturally cloudy in Sydney on all those days. But I have lots of friends in Melbourne and other parts of southern Australia that managed to see aurorae for the first time in their life. Good for them. I'm not jealous at all. Definitely not better. what I did get to see this year that was fantastic.
Yes, I was going to go there.
Yeah. Do you wanna set it up?
No. You got to see it, and I didn't.
Oh, my gosh. It was, I was fortunate enough for the second time in my life to see a total solar eclipse. Both of them now have been in the US. I was lucky enough to be spending a summer in Pasadena for the 2027 eclipse. And then I hopped on a plane that went from LA to Vegas to Denver, and then drove from Denver to Stapleton, Nebraska. That was for the previous one, the Great American Eclipse, as it was called. But this year I was, thankfully right in between visits to, Berkeley and Boston. And I was able to get to upstate New York in time for the eclipse. However, there was a massive cloud front coming in. So my friends and I drove for 4 hours on the morning of the eclipse from upstate New York into Vermont and witnessed amidst the snow, snow on the ground, not in the sky. The sky was perfectly clear. Some like light wispy clouds maybe, but you know, just a perfect, beautiful total solar eclipse. And there are, it's hard to find words to describe it, but the best way that I can express how cool of an experience it is that everybody finishes an eclipse and their first thoughts immediately are, when can I do that again?
Oh, well, there's more coming. There always is.
Yes. You're going to join us for the total solar eclipse here in Sydney in July of 2028.
Okay. All right. Book it.
Cool. I'll make up the sofa bed.
Okay, cool.
It's very cool. Yeah, highly recommend. If anybody has a chance to check out a total solar eclipse, definitely do so. Do so safely. It's just wonderful. And I went, by the way, with a group of my friends who are also astrophysicists. And I, like, on the drive there, I was like, listen, you get space. You understand what's happening. The concept that the moon is just passing in between the sun and the earth. And that doesn't sound impressive. But being there in the moment and seeing that happen and recognizing that that is what's happening, that it's a celestial event, a syzygy, if you will. I think that's the official name for it. That I don't ask me to spell it. Being able to recognize that that's what's happening in real time is just mind-blowing. And these friends of mine were like, yeah, fine, whatever. And then when they experienced it, two of them turned around and was like, you were absolutely right. So yes, great time had by all.
There were some great photos from the space station of this black circle just cruising across the United States.
Just casually cruising.
It's incredible. Just like this one little spot of nighttime in the middle of daytime. Incredible.
Localized nighttime.
Yeah, localized nighttime. Like in The Simpsons.
The Aurora Borealis. In your kitchen this time of year. Yeah. Speaking of giant things covering the sky, did you hear about the Diprotodon?
No. What is the... say it again.
Diprotodon. Ah, I can't even say it. Diprotodon. So the Diprotodon...
Sounds like a dinosaur.
You are not far off, actually.
Yes.
The the Diprotodon is an extinct megafauna from Australia. Basically, the largest wombat that ever existed, right? It was a huge marsupial that would weigh like 3.5 tons. It was like nearly 4 meters long and 2 meters tall. What those units are in eagles per freedom, I don't know, but it's like a big honking wombat. Right,
it's as tall as me and twice as wide as I am tall. There,
I was about to say it's significantly wider than you are. Don't...
It's twice as wide as I am tall. I was right.
But yeah, so this is an extinct giant wombat species. What does this have to do with astronomy in the night sky? Well, basically, there were a group of Australian astronomers who discovered basically there's this massive, massive supernova remnant called G278.94+1.35, which is basically just like the coordinates of this galactic supernova remnant. It's a bubble left over after the shockwave of a supernova explosion in space. And so they basically rediscovered it and it's independently, and it's one of the largest known supernova remnants. And it's basically like, I think the main reason why they had named it, the reason why that they had named it after the Diprotodon is apparently not because the supernova remnant is shaped like a giant wombat. That's what I originally thought. It was just to raise awareness for extinct Australian animals and to raise awareness for like the current extinction rate of several other species in Australia. And because it's one of the largest supernova remnants, they said makes sense that we would name it after one of the largest wombats.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Unfortunate there's an extinction issue, but as a beautiful way to bring awareness to it. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is a spectacular image. Like this is a supernova remnant that is, in terms of like the space that it takes up on the sky, it's like several times the extent or the angular size of the moon. So if you imagine taking like four or five moons side by side and then making like a circle of those moons, that's roughly the size of this supernova remnant. There's a wonderful figure in the paper that shows just how big it is.
I'm looking it up now. All right. I'll save that.
Yes.
Beautiful.
They also have a photo of the Diprotodon in that same image, which kind of scared me because I was like, it's the same size as the moon. But no, it's not. As we said, it was the same height as you and twice as wide as you are tall.
That's right. Oh, God, the Diprotodon is ugly.
Ouch. Wow. If it wasn't extinct, it would be very offended.
It looks like a bear that kind of is hung over and tired and grumpy. I mean,
it was probably one of the last of its species, so you'd also be hung over and tired and grumpy, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay.
Speaking of big things in space, there was a new definition proposed this year for planets. I'm not sure if you heard
about I've it. Heard about this. How Do go on. Sense. Yes, yes, yes. I disagree with it already because it probably excludes Pluto and therefore it doesn't matter. But go on, entertain yourself.
Well, okay, so do you want to remind people what the kind of standard definition is for planets that's currently accepted?
The currently accepted planet definitions for a planet, which was brought about in an attempt to the collateral damage in this new definition of what makes a planet is that Pluto was declassified or reduced from planet to a dwarf planet. But the three categories are it has to orbit the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be pulled into a spherical shape under its own weight or on its own mass, or both. And three, this is the part that I disagree with the most, it has to clear its orbit of any debris, which is nonsense, because Jupiter hasn't done it yet, and no one's messing with Jupiter, and Pluto crosses Neptune's orbit, and that's Pluto itself is now the debris in Neptune's path. And so Neptune's still a planet, and and this law, these laws are put in place by this, you know, momentary blip of a species called human, which is Pluto's going to be around long after we are. And it's going to have plenty of time, billions of years to clear its orbits. So I don't like that rule at all.
It's, yeah, there are lots of people who have issues with those rules, and it's not just the Pluto lovers or the Plutophiles. Yeah, let's go with that. I think the issue is always going to be, right, that we are humans, as you said, that have evolved with particular scales in mind for how we perceive the world around us.
Right.
And trying to use those scales that make sense to us to lump things in the universe into boxes and categories is always going to be somewhat limited. But yes, there is a new definition that was proposed this year Still hasn't come into effect yet, but with this definition, basically a planet is any celestial body that orbits one or more stars, brown dwarfs, or stellar remnants.
Oh, right? That's new.
Yeah, so a stellar remnant could include, let's say, a neutron star, like the leftover core after an explosion. We have detected planets. I think some of the first exoplanets ever detected were around pulsars, which they're not stars, they're not brown dwarfs, they're stellar remnants. A pulsar is a rapidly spinning neutron star. So that's one. Two, it has to be more massive than 10 to the power of 23 kilograms.
Ah.
And it has to be less massive than 13 Jupiter masses, 13 times the mass of Jupiter, which is about 2.5 times 10 to the power of 28 kilograms. What do you think about that? How is that making you feel?
I still don't like the fact that, well, I don't know the mass of Pluto, but it's a hard.
What
it's
if
a
I
hard
tell
rule.
You that it was hard, about?
It's a measurable rule. It's a mass that exists right now. Clearing your orbit is kind of a willy-nilly law because it might not be cleared today, but it will be in time. Earth's orbit wasn't always wonderful. We had a protoplanet and there was debris in our orbit.
Yeah.
So we weren't a planet for a while, even though we were a planet. So, but the mass thing, there's a definitive rule now. If you're smaller than this, you're a dwarf planet or something. If you're bigger than this, you're now on the edge of becoming like a brown dwarf or some kind of something like that. And so that kind of makes sense. So, okay. It's an actual scale, a measurable.
You'll allow it?
I'm not going to. Yeah, I'll allow it. Still.
He says yes.
Still. Pluto's a planet.
Well, as I mentioned, this scale for masses requires the planets between 10 to the 23 and 10 to the 28 kilograms. The sun, for reference, is 10 to the 30 kilograms. Pluto is... you looked it up. I can see his face.
I can 10 see to the 22nd.
Yep.
And the bottom rule is... What's the bottom of the
10 to the 23.
Oh, my God!
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's so messed up. That was totally done on purpose. There's that's just to spite Pluto. That's a. There's no other way. Now I'm back on the. It, I don't like it. Bandwagon. That's terrible. Terrible. Why did they pick 10 to the 23rd? Okay, they probably had some reason, blah, blah, blah. Okay, some sort of scientific event happens at that mass. Okay, all right. No. Because 22 is Pluto.
I mean, listen, like, I didn't decide this. This is other scientists. But you agreed to it, and no backsies.
No backsies. Oh, God. Hey, no.
I know, I'm sorry.
Golly. Well, there's always a gray area. Like, the Vatican is a city, but the Vatican is also a country. So, Pluto is a dwarf planet, but it's also a planet. So I'm going to give it that one. It's the Vatican planet. Done.
I mean... If you're feeling kind of a little bit of animosity towards the quote-unquote real planets now, I do have one other news story from 2024 that might make you feel a sense of happiness or
okay, bring it.
So there was a paper that came out of Australia, actually. Researchers in Australia discovered planet cannibalism. Did you hear about this? At least one in a dozen stars shows evidence of planetary ingestion.
the star eating the planet.
Yeah.
Or the planet eating another planet.
The star eating its own planet. So there are signatures in the chemistry of the stars that show that they have cannibalized, that they have gobbled up planets from their system.
That's awesome.
Right. You have a question? You're raising your hand there.
Guy in the front row. We have seen binary stars.
Yes.
In which one is sucking in the mass of the other.
Mm-hmm.
That's cannibalism, because it's star v star. But this is star v planet. Is that still cannibalism?
Oh, I see what you're saying. You don't now, like...
a planet eats another planet. That's planet cannibalism.
Yes, you're technically right.
There you go. You get the Pluto thing, I get the cannibalism thing. That's where the line is drawn on this show.
It's fine, yes. I think that when they say cannibalism, they're referring to, and the word cannibalism, just for clarity, is not referenced in the paper at all, just in the press releases that went out about it. I think it just refers to the idea of the star of a stellar system consuming some of its own components, being the planets. But yes, you're right. I guess I could, you know, it'd be cool actually. So what you're describing, not exclusively, not all binary star systems like what you're describing are called cataclysmic variables, but there is a subclass of binaries where the stars are close enough that you'll have a white dwarf, right? So that's a star that originally had less than about 8 times the mass of our sun, and then kind of expanded, lost its outer layers and contracted down to this cool and white dwarf core. So cataclysmic variable is a white dwarf and a low mass main sequence star, like an M dwarf or a K dwarf. And they're orbiting so close together that bits of the M dwarf material or K dwarf material is being sucked and pulled onto the white dwarf. That's called a cataclysmic variable, a CV. I think, given your epiphany, we should rename CVs to be called CVs, except the C stands for cannibal.
I support this.
Cannibalistic variables.
There you go. That would be my stamp on M-class stars, because we know I have an issue with M-class.
Yes, because of Star Trek's obsession with M-class planets, which are not a thing.
There's lots of M-class things, and then Star Trek added to it, and it just confuses me.
It's confusing. Yes,
I love
it. It is confusing. Yeah, but that was it for me in terms of astronomy stories. Were there any other big space stories that you wanted to hit? It's been a busy year.
I'll hit one more that I think is actually pretty cool. And it's NASA's Parker Solar Probe.
Yes. How do we?
It made the closest approach ever to the sun. Mm-hmm. 6.1 million kilometers, or 3.8 million freedom miles, of the sun's surface. That's how close it got, and it set the record as the fastest speed ever recorded for a human-made object. Of 692,000 kilometers an hour, or 430,000 freedom miles per hour.
I like it.
The record is the speed, the closeness to the sun, never happened before, and it's just phenomenal. It has sent back recordings of the sound of the sun's atmosphere, because it got so close that it could actually record audio, which is frighteningly beautiful.
That is, terrifying.
It's terrifying. it's like a very intense howling. it's very, very cool. If you can look it up, I recommend looking it up. But again, Parker Solar Probe constantly setting records of how close it gets to the sun. and how fast it's moving because it was closest to the sun. It's awesome. And that record was set in 24. So way to go, 2024. Well done.
Big year. Big year.
China did some cool records with their space station, and India launched incredible amounts of stuff, and China brought samples back from the far side of the moon, and they did that last year. And in order to do that, they sent up a whole bunch of satellites to orbit the moon so they can maintain communication with the thing on the moon. That was big. What else happened?
It's a big, impressive year for humanity.
Big year, big
2025
year.
Will be even bigger.
Yes.
Wow. This is a big year. It's going to be a big year for us, I have to say, not to toot our own horns, but as I mentioned earlier, we've got these great guests coming on next season.
Yes.
We're also getting a new sponsor for the show that we will announce in the first episode of season 6.
Which is coming up in a few weeks, actually.
Coming up very soon.
Where are we right now? We are... Yeah! Let's see. This is episode 8 of season 5, so we have 9 and 10 to do. I think we have a guest that's going to round out season 5.
Yes.
I'm not sure. And then season 6, we're going to come at you. More guests. Sponsors.
More
science. More nerdings. It's going to be awesome.
More nerdings than you can shake a stick at. Yeah. Which is an expression that I never understood. Shaking a stick at. But yes, this will all be incredible. As always, remember that you can find us on the interwebs. You can find me at Fun Fact Science on all of the social media platforms. Benjamin, where can folks find you?
You can find me under the name Science Actually on all the social media platforms. Also, please visit us on TikTok and YouTube and watch our faces make the sounds you're hearing. And if you can, please like, please subscribe wherever you find us, and tell your friends.
Tell your family. Tell your loved ones. Tell the people that you don't necessarily love but you kind of like. Fine. We're not picky.
And if you know anybody in Korea, please tell them to listen to our podcast. I was looking at the map of where all the dots are, and I'm noticing that East Asia is pretty empty. So if anyone in Korea, Japan, I think we have Japan. But anyway, just whatever, anybody. Just, hey, guys. Oh, you know what would be cool? Mongolia, right there in the middle. Bam.
Oh, I have a friend who just came back from Mongolia. If only I knew. If only. But yes, definitely check us out on all the interwebs. Feel free to drop us a message or a comment to let us know what you want to see more of in future episodes, or if you have any recommendations for other fantastic guests across any topic in science. As we said, we're expanding our horizons.
Yes.
And we will see you next time on Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
Bye, everybody.
Here's to another lousy millennium.
10 news auto sound.